Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Hooked on Score. I'm your host, Rick Urban, and with me today, we have Jeremy Turner. Hello, Jeremy.
Hey, Rick, how's it going?
Doing very well. How about yourself?
Hanging in there.
Yeah, it's been a pretty wonderful, stressful week for, I think, everybody. But we're plunging through. Jeremy is one of the composers for the upcoming docu-series, Marvel 616. And this is going to be on Disney Plus. That's the only place it's going to be available. Is that right?
Correct.
Jeremy?
Yeah.
Yeah. As you hear this, it is available right now. So you can go over to Disney Plus and check out that. Did you write the theme as well or just some scoring?
Yeah, I wrote the main title for the 8 episodes.
Okay.
And then I scored one of the 8 episodes. It's a, you know, an anthology series, so 8 different directors, 8 different composers, that whole thing.
It's kind of a docu-series about Marvel, and it's kind of goes behind the scenes and goes into different aspects of Marvel that you haven't really, probably don't have knowledge of, especially like the average Marvel viewer, I would say, for sure.
Definitely. It's kind of a look under the hood and digs a little, some deep cuts in there. Some like you said, things that the average Marvel fan probably doesn't know. I learned all kinds of things, so.
Well, it's a very interesting concept, that's for sure. It's actually kind of great that this Disney Plus is starting to do these deep dives into things. I've seen some kind of behind-the-scenes stuff on Star Wars and on The Mandalorian, and it's almost more interesting than the actual shows themselves in some cases. But
that can be the case sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, we'll get to that in just a moment, but I kind of want to start, Jeremy, if you don't mind. We always kind of start with the same question to our composers here, and that is, how did you get started in music, and then how did that bring about your experiences scoring and what you do today?
That's a good question that could have a very long answer. I kind of took a roundabout way of getting into it. I think at a very early age, I was writing songs as early as 2 and 3, you know, plunking things out on the piano. And
2 or 3 years old, really?
Yeah, I wrote I wrote a song. It's a big hit in my family anyway, called "There Was a Tow Truck in the Desert," and it consists of 2 notes. And I wrote that when I was a little kid at the keyboard. But I started playing piano when I was, you know, somewhat formally, or at least taking lessons when I was about 5.
Wow.
And then I wanted to get an electric guitar and kind of start shredding on that. And my mom was not so into that idea. And she said, there's an early morning strings program in our town in Michigan where I grew up, where I think like twice a week before school, you could go learn how to, you know, play violin or whatever.
It's like a guitar. There's strings involved.
There's strings on it. It's, you know, slightly less noisy with quite a bit less feedback depending on who's playing. But
the one thing parents don't understand is that, yes, a guitar through an amp is very loud and very noisy.
Yeah.
But beginning Suzuki violin is intolerable to listen to.
Yeah, I don't think she's... my mom was a very smart woman, and I think she probably knew what she was doing. But yeah, that's a good point, especially these days. You could just, you know, leave a kid alone in his bedroom with an amp and some headphones, and you really wouldn't hear everything as much as you would with a you know, pint-sized violin. But but anyway, yeah, she said, why don't you take violin or something like that for a year? And if you don't like it, then we'll get you maybe an acoustic guitar. But she was very not into having an electric guitar in the house. And so I started out on violin and very quickly realized, you know, it was dark out. It was very early in the morning. I realized that the cellos were the only ones that got to sit down. So after a couple of weeks, I switched to cello so I could sit down and kind of, you know, it also gives you something to kind of rest on a little bit. And then that was that. I one by one,
And this was in, you grew up in Michigan, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, East Lansing, Michigan. And so, yeah, all other instruments and activities and sports and various things dropped off, and cello was kind of became, you know,
the
yeah. And so when it came time to go to, you know, formal training, I only applied to conservatories, and I didn't go to any universities, and kind of put all my eggs in one basket, and music was going to be the thing, and was fortunate enough to, you know, join a really great orchestra at a pretty young age. And so I had a whole career as a performer, playing in the orchestra, playing with bands that, you know, would come through town in New York, and then finally got around to playing the electric guitar, like in my mid-20s, late-20s. And so I finally got back to my original dream of 1982 or whatever that was. After a while, decided that it was time for a shift, and started to write music for, you know, short films and commercials and, you know, whatever I could get my hands on. And then one thing led to another, and that started becoming, you know, feature films and TV series and things like that. So,
wow. So I read you got into the Met at age 21. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was a wee lad, as they say.
So for our listeners that don't know, the Met, that's kind of the dream job for an orchestral musician, not one easily come across. And at 21, that's not really a thing you usually leave. That's kind of a lifelong job when you land that job. So that must
have
been...
that's what I thought when I joined, too. And felt very fortunate to have that job, and it was wonderful. And I played there for 14 years. I think due in small part to me joining the orchestra at such a young age and having such a long road in front of me, you know, it takes a couple of years, but after you get through the standard repertoire, the Met would play anywhere between, I don't know, probably 28 and 32 different operas a year. But once you get those under your belt, it started to Groundhog Day, as I say, you know, kind of started to set in for me. And I was like, all right, what else is out there? And so I started broadening my musical horizons, and
only play Carmen so many times. Right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And yeah, as they say, life is short and operas are long. So yeah, it came time to, you know, roll the dice and push forward with some new musical horizons. And it got to a point where I think my dad and my accountant were probably the lone holdouts in there. You know, why would you leave this job? This is the golden handcuffs.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that's in a job as unstable as musician in any facet.
Sure.
Leaving, you know, the one area is landing a job in an orchestra.
Right.
And for film composers that don't know, to get a job in an orchestra, a major symphony orchestra, it's a journey. You have to wait for a timing, for a spot to be open. And when people get these jobs and they get tenure, they don't leave until they retire, usually.
Yeah, they used to say there's really ever only two times where an opening would appear, and it was usually when somebody died or somebody retired, and that was about it. So
that must have been a really big decision on your part to leave that.
It took some exploration. You know, once I started realizing that I was using my income from the orchestra to fund other musical pursuits, and it really became clear to me that I needed a shift. So I started a small studio with a friend down in Chelsea in New York. And I coincidentally had a band, of which the drummer in the band was one of the percussionists from the orchestra. And yeah, so there was a couple nights where, you know, we would play an opera and then, you know, take off the tuxedos and jump in a cab and go downtown and go play a band gig. and so I just started living this dual life, and it just became more and more clear to me that I was having more fun creating music and writing music and you know, putting my toes in other musical waters, and that, you know, became the path forward for me.
So you you are in New York when you start film composing, is that right?
Yeah, I was, yeah, the first two films I scored were, I think, I want to say it was 2013. Okay. It was two films. It was a documentary called Narco Cultura, which premiered at the Sundance Festival, and a narrative film with Ben Kingsley called A Birder's Guide to Everything, and that, I think, premiered at Tribeca Film Festival, if I remember right. So yeah, that was kind of, those were my first two, you know, film scores. And then I met my now wife, who was living in LA at the time. So we kind of started doing this back and forth, New York, LA, long distance relationship thing. And I had been in New York for 20 years at the time then, and was kind of ready for something new and, you know, ready to explore things out west. And so took the plunge and packed up all my instruments and drove across the country. So.
Wow. And at that point, you had enough credits where you felt comfortable kind of that you would get work at that point?
Yeah, I knew it was still a roll of the dice, but I could, you know, I couldn't really imagine not doing it. So yeah. I mean, once you make that decision, it's like, okay, this is what I need to do for, you know, whether it's your soul or, you know, your heart or your mind or whatever, you just kind of roll the dice and go for it. So yeah, I had a few credits, but you know, still, even today, you know, still climbing the ladder. So
yeah, and the music that I've heard of yours, it seems like you transitioned into cinematic style music pretty easily. Well, at least at this point, you're pretty darn good at it. It doesn't sound like an orchestral musician writing film music. It sounds like a film composer writing film music. So was there a change in sort of the way you approach music?
I wouldn't say there's a change per se. I mean, I think, you know, depending on how experimental the project is that you're working on, you know, there's only so far you can push things. You know, you're not going to write, you know, some crazy atonal mix meter, you know, avant-garde piece for Marvel 616. But, yeah, certainly playing in the orchestra for all those years, and then growing up as a lover of film and, you know, whether it was Hitchcock stuff with Bernard Herrmann or all the Spielberg and John Williams collaborations, or, you know, that stuff's ingrained in you. And so it's just, yeah, you kind of put on your film composer hat and take what you've learned from the classical music background, but, you know, realize that it needs to be perhaps slightly more easily digestible, you know, for a broader public. But ultimately just serving the story that you're scoring to. So it's not, you know, when I write music for the stage or a standalone piece, then, you know, that you can do whatever you want, but you know, you have to factor in, you know, various things when you're composing for film
And I think I read that you are, I thought I saw a Mike Nichols project.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That ended up being the last play he ever directed. Yeah, that was a wonderful, wonderful, opportunity. It was, Harold Pinter's Betrayal. Okay. And it was, it's a 3-person play. It's an incredible play. It was Daniel Craig, Rachel Weisz, and Rafe Spall. And wow. My friend...
So relatively unknown actors.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was actually pretty funny. My friend James Murphy had been tapped to write some sort of interstitial music for the production. And he came over to my house and... you know, he's a brilliant musician, but, you know, we have different skill sets. And I think he was quickly realizing that he was going to need a little bit of help with this one. And, I didn't know much about it.
Well, the reason why it was interesting to me is because that's not something you think about music. You think about music for musicals, but not a straight up play, you know?
And, right. It was a bold choice of Mike to want to do. You know, you see that occasionally. I mean, I saw a couple plays last year in New York before the world ground to a halt, and sometimes it's somebody backstage is hitting play on something that's been pre-recorded. Sometimes it's performed, you know. But
yeah.
Anyway, they had this idea that they wanted some music for the set changes, which were very poetic and slow moving and almost like miniature vignettes, ballets,
furniture ballet.
Yeah, kind of. That was sort of what it was like, and it was a funny story. I remember I unfortunately had to go to a funeral in the morning, and James said, you know, can you come meet me up at Lincoln Center? We're going to watch a read through of this play. And all I knew that was that Mike Nichols was directing it. So I was already like, you know, wow. You know, I mean, that's doesn't get any more legendary than that. And so I show up, you know, with a suit on, and they're probably thinking like, who's this nerd with a, you know, shows up to like a read through when everyone's in jeans and, you know, I've got this suit on. But yeah, we watched this read through of the play in this very raw way. You know, there were scripts on the ground, and obviously all three actors were just incredible. And it was pretty amazing. And then we watched that, and that was that. And then we sat down at a table, and it was me and James and Mike and Scott Rudin and Eli Bush. And all of a sudden I was just like, where am I? I feel like I just skipped like, 10 steps here.
Yeah.
And, we had this long discussion about what the sound of it should be. And, James and I went down to his studio in the Village and, stayed up late and wrote a couple cues and sent it to Mike in the morning, and he loved it, and that was that. And you know, the fun thing for me, that while that wasn't a particularly taxing job, because it was just pretty much me on cello and James on piano and us just hanging out in the studio and drinking coffee and making sounds together for a long time, it was really fun getting to go to the theater and watching Mike work with the actors and the attention to detail, and whether it was costumes or lighting and just seeing that whole thing come together. And then also the fun thing, you know, about a play as opposed to film, every night it was different, you know, it had different reactions and different performances. And so it was, it was a really wonderful experience. That was one of the last big projects I did in New York before I moved west. But I will always remember that as a very, you know, special moment.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Marvel 616. A lot of, if you're not familiar with what 616 is, it's kind of the Marvel term for the Marvel universe that's bigger than the MCU. Is that right? Bigger than the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
Yeah, it's, I had to look it up too. It's sort of the alternate universe, or like the world outside your window, but it's sort of Earth 616, but it's the Marvel Earth, as I understand it. We both might get dinged on that by the super fans, but I'm pretty sure that kind of sums it up. So
It's funny, we've been doing like a deep dive into Star Trek recently. Uh-huh. And, you know, I'm not in any way a super fan of Star Trek, so I'm sure I've been getting dinged all over the place. But
yeah, you don't want to upset the Trekkies, man. Bad things can happen.
Well, we're about to kind of do a dive into the first phase of the Marvel movies.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do, I'm assuming you did some research if you hadn't already seen all these films. Did you do a fair amount of research going into this project?
Yeah, I'd seen the majority of the Marvel films. And so, you know, I didn't necessarily have to do research. I have a pretty good memory for film scores and certainly sounds of film scores. So I had a good feeling, you know, in my mind's ear of what you know, the Marvel fans would want to hear, and you know, this, the kind of sort of grand, majestic, triumphant, you know, heroic scores that they're used to. So, yeah.
Well, the episode, the theme, it definitely, you nailed the Marvel vibe for the theme for sure.
Thank you.
But the episode you did was, it surrounds Marvel superheroes that are not really well known.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, some of the B, C, even D list Marvel celebrities. Yeah, if they can even be called celebrities. Yeah.
So in a way, you don't really have to draw out Captain America's theme or anything like that, because you know you're talking about superheroes that nobody knows about.
Yeah,
they don't
that was kind of. Yet everybody's a legend in their own mind, right? So, so there was kind of some of the characters. You know, lesser known characters. I mean, we used everything from, you know, a theremin to a lap steel guitar to, you know, there's some pretty goofy ones in there. But then what was fun was getting to use that big orchestral action adventure sound for, you know, Paul's head.
Yeah.
And yeah, like Paul in Paul's head.
Kind of a talking head documentary.
Yeah. But Paul, you know, if you get into Paul's head, and it's all very tongue in cheek, but he's creating this, you know, the greatest documentary that's ever been made. And he's got to do all these epic things. And so it was kind of fun using that, you know, pedal to the metal sound for that, even though it was done in a bit of a, you know, with a wink and a nod. So.
Yeah. The, Paul Scheer is the one that kind of he's the one that brings you through the episode, and he's the one that's kind of the subject of this documentary for this episode. And Paul Scheer is from, well, I know him from The League, but he's been in many things, actually.
He's been in a lot of things. Yeah, he even worked with my wife on, I think it was Children's Hospital, and, you know, he's directed, he's acted, he's written Marvel comic books before. He has a podcast. You know, he's a multi-talented guy.
Yeah. So when you were writing the music, is this the first time you did a theme that was kind of this on this scale for Disney Plus and for that kind
definitely,
of thing?
Definitely. Yeah. The few main title themes that I've done, you know, have typically been for, you know, a Netflix series that I'm working on, or, you know, yeah, I've certainly done it before, but yeah, when you see the word Marvel and Disney, it's suddenly, you know, it takes on a life of its own.
It's a bigger deal.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
And, when you approached it, did they give you temp music to write around, or did they have any idea?
There was no temp music. I wrote the main titles. God, it must've been almost a year ago at this point. But it was before I had started work on the episode. And we had a conference call with Pat Clare, who was the main title designer. And he's brilliant. I mean, he's done main titles for Westworld and True Detective. And, you know, he does really, really beautiful work. And so we had a call with the producers and Pat, who's in Sydney, Australia, and myself, and I just asked him a bunch of questions. You know, what is it going to look like? What is it going to feel like? So that I could kind of get some ideas. And we talked about timing and that kind of thing. And then I just kind of wrote the piece of music. So I had no picture to write to. We were going to kind of do like a chicken and egg thing and pass it back and forth. And but it just turned out that the thing that I wrote, everybody loved, and he just animated to that, and that was that. So it was a bit unusual. Like I was expecting, you know, a bunch of versions and tweaks and revisions, but the first thing I wrote ran the gauntlet and made it through. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's it's very Marvel, very cinematic, and still fits kind of the sort of documentary part of it.
Yeah.
So it's a nice chameleon piece, if you will, for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you did the Aaron Hernandez doc as well.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that was also last fall. That was right around the time I was working on on the episode for 616. But
and the music for that is drastically different.
Yeah, that was a very different sound. That was, you know, that's the strange thing when you're a composer or an actor, or, you know, is you almost become a split personality, you know, especially when you've got overlapping projects.
Yeah,
that was, you know, a particularly dark subject matter, and a lot of the music was very synth driven and almost kind of this post-apocalyptic Blade Runner type sound. And and then switching gears into you know, Paul's episode, where you're doing some kind of light orchestral comedy scoring, you know, it was very different beast.
The documentary series is called Killer Inside. For the Aaron Hernandez documentary. Was that Netflix?
That was Netflix, yeah.
Yeah. And that was a pretty big deal. That was a, you know, obviously a huge story when it happened and everything like that. It's kind of something that people have kind of forgotten about recently.
Yeah. There was some interesting developments in that too that I don't think made it all the way to the public eye, and I being, you know, a mild football fan, I didn't even know, you know. So there was a lot of interesting developments in that story that, you know, were a surprise to me. So
well, getting back to the 616, it is on Marvel 616. It's on Disney Plus as you hear this episode. And the is it a mini, or there's going to be multiple seasons of this, or we don't know yet, or they don't know yet, or
I'm not sure even I know that yet. So far, there's 8 episodes in the first season, and I mean, I could certainly see it continuing. There are, what I learned from working on it is there's over 8,000 characters in the Marvel universe, so. You know, that blew my mind. So, yeah, I mean, one would think that you could run this series for years to come and still uncover new stories. So, yeah.
The one other question I wanted to ask, when you were scoring this, was this during the pandemic or was this all done before?
You know, a lot of this 616 work was done during the pandemic. Fortunately for me, it was one of the last projects I worked on before.
Okay.
So my episode and the main titles, we finished, I want to say it's like early December last year. We went up to Skywalker and did, you know, the final mixes there. And then, yeah, but I know they were continuing to work on it, you know, through the pandemic, and that obviously changed
a lot
of people's plans. So,
yeah, unfortunately, that's been a question I've been asking composers during these interviews is, so, you know, how did you do the project with, you know, not having able to have musicians like in the same room as each other and things like that? But
it definitely presents a lot of challenges. You know, I was fortunate enough to have a handful of projects to work on, you know, during lockdown and when everything went upside down back in March. And, but yeah, when it came time to record, and put things together, yeah, you definitely have to be, as anybody does these days, depending on what you do for a living, but you really had to get creative with how you put things together. And it took a lot more time and a lot more planning. And
yeah, I know a lot of musicians that their first investment for the pandemic was getting a really good mic, because
yeah,
they were in sound treatment for their house.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have a favorite Marvel score? Not film, but
I don't think I do really. I like bits and pieces of all of them, and I know it's a very politically safe answer, but
yeah, it's funny, we've been, because for so long we kind of had a mandate when we first started doing Hooked on Score. We weren't really going to talk about the Marvel scores, just because they've been so talked about and they're so present. And, you know, I mean, what are you going to say about an Alan Silvestri score? You know, I mean, it's perfect. Okay, good. Let's move on. You know, it's,
I mean, certainly his, you know, his main theme is epic and awesome and does exactly what it needs to do. And, you know, he's a tremendous talent for sure.
Yeah. But we decided to kind of change gears because, you know, for the past decade or so, this was kind of the juicy territory
sure
for writing especially dramatic, you know, epic cinematic film music. That's, you know, there's nothing you can do more. You know, they're never going to tell you to back off in a Marvel movie.
that's exactly right. It's, you know, turn the horns up, turn the snare drum up, you know, more cymbals, more tremolo.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Jeremy. Is there anything else that we should know about you? You have any other projects coming up? I know it's a very stressing time for composers because there hasn't been things in production, so we're kind of a little bit behind.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think there's going to be a little bit of a dip, a little bit of a lull, you know, before things kind of catch up. No, there's a couple projects I worked on, you know, during the beginning of the pandemic that I was particularly proud of. There's a couple episodes of Chef's Table on Netflix, which is always fun. And then Immigration Nation, which is a 6-part series on Netflix, which is, you know, really, really great. And upcoming, I'm now working on a Hulu film. And so, you know, there's a few more things coming out, but it's nice to have some time to kind of work on one thing at a time right now and slow things down a bit. So.
Wow. Yeah. So those two last that you mentioned there, Chef's Table and Immigration Nation, are on Netflix. And then Marvel 616 is on Disney Plus. You can see all this stuff without having to leave your house.
Exactly.
Because you can't anyways, but... well, thank you again so much for being with us here today. I want to thank my guest, Jeremy Turner, and we will see you next week.
Thanks, Rick. Have a good one.
Thank you, Jeremy.